Welcome to the CFO Show. I'm your host, Melissa Howitson, CFO of Venice Solutions. Deciding to take a company public is a huge decision for any business. How do you know if your company is ready? Operationally, do you have in place the foundational building blocks that you're going to need to make it as a public company? To help us understand the early stages of going public and what life looks like after you've gone public, we wanted a boots-on-the-ground perspective from somebody who has multiple experiences doing this. Joining us today to talk about taking a company public, we have Donna DeLomo, former EVP and CFO and current Senior Strategic Advisor with Lovesac. Donna, thank you so much for joining me.
Melissa, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
So, Donna, you've had a fair bit of experience with public companies. Can you talk a bit about that background and your career journey?
Sure. So it spans over 37 years, which is a rather long time, but a lot of strategy built into that planning. Started out in public accounting to get my CPA, like many people do who are on that path. Then after getting certified, went into a public company and started back in about 1998, I think it was. I went to a public company which was involved in fitness, building out their internal audit program, because for public companies, we all know, which we'll probably talk a little bit more about, on in how internal controls are so important. So built out their internal audit department, worked to graduate to corporate controller. I was at that company for about 9 years. And they actually went through a reverse merger at the time, moved off of Long Island, which is where I was living. So I made a career, or not even a career change, but just a job change, and moved to a fragrance company that was looking to go public. Took us about 10 years, but I went over to a company called Quality King Fragrance at the time. And again, they wanted to take their fragrance division. They had multiple divisions. They wanted to take their fragrance division public. Took us about 10 years. And we did it actually through a reverse triangular merger, which we may talk a little bit more about. And that's when the private company, which is what I was a part of, merged into a public company, but we became the parent. So essentially taking a private company, putting it into a public company, and then becoming a public company. I did that. I was with that company for about 19 years, again, going private to public over the course. I was there taking it from 50 million to about 550 million. And then I had a very unique opportunity to join Lovesac to take a private company that was around when I joined them. For they were about 19 years old at that point, although not many people were aware of the company Lovesac. But I did have an opportunity at that point to join them and take them from private to public, which I did. I was there for about a year and a half. So I joined there in January of 2017, and we IPO'd in June of 2018.
So lots of different public company experience. And you talk about this reverse triangular merger. Help me understand a little bit more about what that looked like.
Sure. So interesting fact is that when I was with Cybex, we went through a reverse merger where we were the public company, which merged with a private company, and therefore that moved off of Long Island to Massachusetts. But I was with Perfumania. We went through a reverse triangular merger, which took, I was with the private side of the company, and then we merged into a public. But the triangular piece of it is, if you think about a triangle having three points, right, and that's probably the easiest way to think about it, is you have two companies, the acquiring company and the target company, but there's a third company that's formed. It's a subsidiary of the acquiring company, which becomes that other point of the triangle. And that's why it's called a triangular merger. And the acquiring company forms this subsidiary, which then acquires the target company, and it merges into that newly formed subsidiary. That's that triangle. So where, when I was working in private, we had a Quality King Fragrance and we had a Perfumania, which was the public company, and we formed Perfumania Holdings, which took the private company and the public company, and it put it into that other point of the triangle, which was the reverse triangular merger. Therefore, the private company got the stock, received stock in exchange for cash for the acquisition, and therefore became the parent of the public company. That's like a very, like in a nutshell, summary of what a reverse triangle. There's a lot more than that, you know, acquiring all the assets and the liabilities. But if you just think about that triangle, the triangle involves 3 points. It involves the acquiring company, the target company, and then a subsidiary, which both of the acquirer and the target merge into.
So before we go any further, Donna, can you help us understand better, what is Lovesac? What is the product that they sell?
So Lovesac is what we call a design for life furniture company. And there's two specific product lines that they sell. They sell a sactional, which is modular couch. And I, the way I always say it, it's like the Lego of couches, because that's really what it is. And then they sell Saks. It was a company that was not geographically desirable for me because I lived on Long Island and their company was based out of Stamford, Connecticut. They were private, which was fine. They were private equity owned. There was no more equity, private equity money being put into the business, and they were losing a ton of money. So everything would tell you. And by the way, I took a pay cut in all this. There was a pay cut involved with that. But each time I met with, again, the vision board was the reason why I even decided to even entertain the opportunity. But looking, having researched the company, Lovesac, and looking at the brand, it's, you know, my career being first in the fitness industry and then in the fragrance industry, it was really important for me to be with a brand that I really believed in the brand. And that's, you know, one of my root values is that I need to believe in the philosophy and the brand of a company. You know, doing finances of a company is great, but being with a company that you really believe in the brand is what, like, is the icing on the cake. But anyway, did a lot of research on the company itself and just kept meeting with the founder, Sean Nelson, and meeting with him and the board and the president of time, and just looking at their strategy and again the relativeness of the brand, I kept coming home to my husband saying, "I just want to help them. They're there. They have the right brand. They have the right strategy. They just needed a little bit more subject matter experts, right, across the board." And you know, talked a lot about it with my husband to say, if I was given the opportunity, I would absolutely jump on it. I mean, the fact that they wanted to go public was probably, that was an attraction as well, but also a concern, right? This was a company that was around for 19 years, you know, owner-led, founder-led, and, you know, do they really understand what it takes to take a company public and remain as a public company? You know, there's a lot of scrutiny, as which probably we'll talk about, and everybody knows your business. So it's very, very different than being a private company. Not from, you know, the quality of the financial statements and everything else, but just, you know, who's always looking over your shoulder. So that was the one takeaway each time I would meet with the management team and the board, no matter how hard I kept saying I want to help them. But in the back of my mind, I was like, do they really know what this means, taking a company public and being a public company? But I love the brand right away. I own a lot of their product. And the people, the culture, the value, the sustainability, everything that Lovesac represents. So that was the easy sell for me, right? And everything else where I said it was geographically undesirable, I knew I could get past that. Taking a pay cut, I knew I could get past that. But just wanting to really help them achieve the goals that they've been setting out for themselves, and just really building a team and process and strategy around what do we do to get this company public and then, you know, maintain in the public domain.
And so you took a chance with your career, it sounds like. You joined them. How did you start to know that the company was ready to go public? Was it a certain growth level? Was there a catalyst event?
One of the many things that drove me to Lovesac was their strategy, right? So, and it wasn't necessarily, hey, the minute we become profitable is the year that we need to go public, or the year that our sales volume reaches, I'm making up a number, $500,000 or $500 million, or whatever it may be. because we were about $79 million at the time I joined them. So it wasn't a sales target. It wasn't a profitability target. It was really, do we have the foundation? Is our foundation ready to go public, right? And the foundation is probably the most boring thing of anything you can do. It's not the sparkly thing. It's not the sexy thing in that what you do. It may not be sexy, but it's necessary. So it was when we thought we, you know, had plans that we felt very confident, because you don't want to disappoint the street. You know that as being a public company, right? You don't want to disappoint your associates. And we felt that we were ready at that point. Our plan was there. Our foundation, foundation takes a long time, but we felt the foundation was at a point that we were ready to go. We felt that the plans that we built were achievable and you know, not disappointing. We, you know, that's really what it was. So we didn't have a sales target. We didn't have a gross margin target. We didn't have an adjusted EBITDA target. We didn't have a net income target. We had a foundational target and where we felt really, really confident in that we could produce the results that we said we would to our shareholders, our stakeholders.
And you talk about that foundation, and it really is, even though it's maybe not the sexy part of things, it is a critical piece, that operational rigor that needs to be there or to a certain level in order to go public. Can you talk a bit about some of the key ingredients that went into that?
It goes through all levels of the organization. It's internal and external. So it was from board support to executive management support to building out the right financial team. And I will tell you that you know, that took years to do that. That was not something that happened in a day. And it was something that we continued to do even after we IPO'd. You know, having the right partners externally as well, whether it's auditors or bankers or lawyers, having the right IR strategy, right? So it's all that foundation. The systems, I will tell you, systems are key. Systems are key to make sure that you have the right controls in place and you can get the information within the timelines that you know, there's a lot to you said around operational rigor, especially around timeline, right? It wasn't like we can ask the SEC that we need a little bit more time, you know, somebody went on vacation or, you know, somebody had a baby and we, you know, we're not able to get our financials or what it may be. So it's all that financial rigor around that. And really educating all of your management team, you know, all levels of management and supervisory to what it really takes to be, what does it mean to be a public company? It sounds good. You know, hey, I got stock in a public company and we're public and we have a really cool ticker symbol, which for Lovesac is love. You know, all that sounded really good. But what does that mean behind when you peel back the onion, right? There's a lot there when you continue to peel back. And what is it? What's really happening behind that, you know, that green curtain, like the wizard on Wizard of Oz, like what's happening that you don't see behind the curtain? It's all that stuff that you need to make sure that's operating effectively. But that takes time. And again, I will tell you that it wasn't perfect when we IPO'd, but we were at a point that we feel very confident. And then you have to continue to look at that operational rigor and continue to build it out. And I'm not quite sure any company is fully done doing that, you know, because I believe any process can probably be made better, anything like that. But you need to be open to that as well, that it's a continuing to evolve process, but it needs to be pretty stable when you decide to do an IPO.
Yeah, that you talk about that stability, that predictability, you know, some of those key parts that have to be in place. Let's talk for a minute about market and market timing. How big a factor was that in the decision?
Well, I think it's important for any company. You know, when you're heading into a financial crisis, obviously and the markets aren't open to IPOs. There's, you know, there are probably bunches of companies that were just on the brink that pull back and put themselves on a shelf for a while and just reevaluate. So I think market conditions is probably one of the top conditions as well, is when you think about just what your, you know, your foundational, and is the market ready for you? Do you have a differentiated product, right? Can you tell the story? How is your story going to be perceived? For Lovesac, it's a very, very unique product. So I will say it was easy to tell the story. But the market has to be ready for that. You know, it has to be ready for, oh, not just another, you know, in Lovesac's case, not just another furniture company. Like, what's really distinctive? Can you really tell the story on what your brand, why are you different? You know, why does an investor really want to take a chance on this company versus one of your competitors? Is it relevant? You know, will it continue to stay relevant? And that's where I think any company, whether you're private or company, private or public, it's the relevance of your product is super important. It's just, there's a lot more eyes on you when you're a public company on the relevance of your product and how do you stand out about, you know, above the rest. So really, is the market ready for something like that? You know, today's day and age is probably all over technology, you know, IA and all of that. You know, if that's what the market is focusing on and you come out with a brand that's not really going to stand up, maybe it's not AI, it's something different, or even when it was pharmaceuticals, whatever it may be, the timing in the market is super, super important. Is the market ready for you? And do they really understand what it is that your company does and how your brand will resonate with others?
And you talk about the storytelling and the importance of having the operational rigor. You'd also mentioned about the advisors and having the right advisors. What are some of the thought process, or how did you know you had the right advisors when you think about picking a banker and making sure you had the right auditor, for instance?
Understanding your culture, your values, yours meaning the company's, and making sure that your advisors, whether they are lawyers, auditors, bankers specifically, hold those same values. And, you know, I go back to really understanding the brand, especially on the banker side, because they are going to be integral in telling your story, right? The management team goes along and presents the story as well, but your bankers are the ones that are out there first, right? They're going to understand your market. They're going to understand the investors. They have the relationship with the investors. They know market conditions, but it's really important that you pick these advisors and auditors as you would pick associates, right? That hold your same values, and otherwise it's not going to work, right? And I will tell you, for Lovesac, we used Roth Capital, which is, you know, it wasn't the Goldman Sachs of the world and it wasn't the Bank of America's of the world. First of all, they probably wouldn't even looked at Lovesac. I mean, that goes into it too, right? Which financial partners are willing to, I don't want to say take a risk, or but really believe in your story. And we were very fortunate to work with Roth Capital Partners, and they are still very involved with Lovesac. And is it the right fit? But I will say that with the auditors, like I said, I'll say that with the lawyers. It's, you interview them as you would with a prospective associate that you want to work with, because hopefully you'll be working with them for a very long time.
Great advice there. And my experience has been the same, that those selections and putting a lot of rigor into making sure that there's going to be a good fit is critical, because you spend a lot of time and you're up against tight deadlines as you go, and you need to know that this is going to be a solid partnership for sure. Let's talk a little bit about team structure. What were some of the changes you made prior to going public? And then what were some of the ones that you were making after?
You'll constantly need to evolve your team, whether it's finance and accounting or other teams within the organization. But specifically for finance and accounting, when I joined Lovesac, 99% of the finance and accounting people were temps. So it took, yes. My first hire was somebody on the FP&A team. Otherwise, straight from accounting and accounts receivable and accounts payable, and they were all temporary associates. So It was starting and saying, what do we think we need? What's the skill set we need? And that changes, that constantly evolves. So there's a good chance, I will tell you, for Lovesac, where we were in 2018 with a team and where Lovesac is today evolved. And it is very different and it has grown. And it's okay to say that maybe the skill set you needed is not what you necessarily thought at the time. Or to be quite honest, there might be people who were part of the team prior to going public that might not understand the rigor and the commitment. And I'll use the term sacrifice, you know, to however you choose to define that it takes to be a public company, from private to company, private to public, and, you know, not missing deadlines and working some extra hours and continuing to build that foundation. I always say, you know, at Lovesac, you don't come in thinking that you're just going to take a process manual and follow that, right? It's you come in, and if there's a process documented, which you will have most likely for control standpoint, it's how do you make it better, right? How do you make the process more efficient? How do you work smarter, not harder, right? And making sure that you have the right team that's willing to come in and do this and not just continue the same path that was there, always challenging the process, always looking to make it better. So I think with anything, you know, personally, professionally, you feel like you always want to evolve, right? And I think that with your teams and everything else that you work with, it's a constant evolution process. Not that you're churning people, because you don't want to do that either, but it's an evolution that will continue as the company evolves. Teams will evolve as well. You should be in a position where you say, okay, I feel good where I don't do that role anymore. And I'm going to get somebody else to do that for me and partner with me or work alongside me. So it's a professional and it's a personal, you know, evolution. I think we all should look to do that.
I used to have a board member who would say, sometimes there's different horses for different courses and that's okay. And it always stuck with me in terms of, you know, it's great when people can come along, adapt, and sometimes they can't and it's not the right place or time. And that's where you'd have to just keep evolving things as you go. So some great insights. And after you went public, what would have been some of the additional changes that you think came in even after? Because I think a lot of times people forget, it's almost like the IPO is the big event and they think, okay, now we've arrived, but you've really just begun the new journey. What were some of the things you had to change with the team after?
I'm always thinking about the financial costs. So I never wanted to build a team too big. And I would think about, no, we can do that with the current resources. And then I'd see all these other teams out there building and growing. And I'm like, but not that we said we were more fiscally responsible, but I'd be like, we can add a little bit more. I think being open and acknowledging that finance and accounting needs to build at the same pace that the rest of the company is building. And it's okay. You know, you don't want to overbuild either, but it's okay to acknowledge that maybe you need more people focusing on your controls, or maybe you need more people focusing on your how to do the SEC filings or whatever it may be. I think that's one of my takeaways, is I've always tried to do more with less, but that's not always the right answer, right? I think because then you suffer burnout across the board and you could miss things. And I think it's being open to really what are the right positions at the right time, right? You could go to IPO and you come out of public company and say, oh, I need internal investor relations, or you need a whole SEC team. It's probably not the right time, but knowing when the right time to build those functions out are, and not, how do I want to say this? Knowing it's okay to ask for those extra dollars, not only in building out the team, but the IT needed to support the finance, because that is critical. You know, you look at, again, the sexy stuff, whether it's a new POS system or a new warehouse management software. You never really hear about, wow, we were able to do our SEC filing in 3 less days because we got this really cool SEC tool, or we took where we used to have to make 150 adjusting journal entries at the end of the month to get our financial statements right, we're down to 15. You don't hear about that. That's not the stuff people talk about, but it is the stuff that really creates that foundational support. So I guess for me, it would be raising my hand a little bit more about building out finance and really building out the technology a little quicker than what we probably did. That's my takeaway on that.
Great piece of advice. And following on from that, when you think about, I'm sure when you came in, given your prior experience, you expected a few roadblocks and challenges. What would those key ones be? And what was maybe an unexpected roadblock that you encountered along the way?
I think the expected was what it would take to build out the team. And just getting all the buy-in and, you know, as far as executive management and everything is what it takes to be a public company. So there was more. The unexpected was all the macro headwinds that we hit. You know, we IPO'd in June of 18, and then in September of 19, tariffs hit. And at that point, the China tariffs, and at that point, 80% of the product that we were bringing in from China. And what did that do? That put a 25%, well, first 15, then it went to 25%, put an additional 25% cost on all of our products. We never thought about that. So we navigated through tariffs. We were very fortunate at the time, though, that outside of China, the founder, Sean Nelson, had already been planning to diversify supply chain. So he was already in looking at Vietnam and other countries over there. So we probably were able to spin up alternate supply chains a lot quicker than a lot of other companies that were being hit with the tariffs. But no way did we anticipate tariffs. The next thing was COVID. I'm not quite sure anybody. And, you know, our showrooms at the time were the biggest piece of our revenue. So there was not a time prior to COVID that we ever thought about what would happen if, let's just shut all of our showrooms at once and see how this works for us. We were fortunate that our showrooms are exactly that, right? They're touch feel point. So it wasn't like you were going into a showroom and walking out with a sectional or a sack or anything like that. But they were touch feel points. And you're going to spend $3,000, $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 on a couch or something. You probably want to touch and feel it prior to buying it. But nowhere in any of our strategy did we ever think about just shutting them all down and seeing what would happen. But that's exactly what we needed to do. You know, we need to shut everything down. And the advantage that I think that we had is that one of our advantages, we always talked about our business being omni-channel, but how did you really define that, right? It's like omni-channel, you can go into a showroom and you can order online, or you can order online, or you can go, you see it online and go into a showroom. But this really tested all of us by, we shut them all down. The team pulled together. We were extremely agile. We took our showroom associates and made them, you know, Facebook, I would call them aficionados, and they were doing Facebook demos and then helping people. They were working from home, and how do you order this online? And we actually, I don't want to use the word benefit, but we did not lose any sales at all because we were extremely agile. Would we shut down all our showrooms ever again if we didn't have to? No, but it got us through that. And it said, you know, it really trained our associates to be what we call customer love associates as well. So COVID was one. And then it was all of the supply chain headwinds with container costs. So 2.5 years ago, we were paying $5,000 a container to come in. And then, you know, right after that, we were paying $25,000. That was not only Lovesac, that was, you know, anybody that was bringing, sourcing product from overseas. So some of the plans and what we've talked about is not disappointing the street, you know, where we said when our original story out there was we can have, you know, gross margins above 60% and all of a sudden they're down to 50 and they're like, what happened? Well, we've got tariffs and we have container costs. And so when you say the headwinds or some of the things that you, they're typically those macroeconomic things that you can't plan for. But the important thing there is to be agile enough to actually address them. That's what the key is there. Cause will they stop? There'll be different forms of them, right? There'll be just something different, maybe 2 or 3 years from now. It'll just be called something different, whatever it may be. But having the right management in place to say, let's pull together and how do we deal with this? How do we deal with it effectively? How do we deal with it efficiently? And how do we communicate this to all of our stakeholders? That's the important part.
Boy, you must have had some sleepless nights through those events. I can only imagine. You touched on something that's really important. You talked about that agility. And I think that's one of the things when you become a public company, you need a lot more rigor and structure, but you have to keep that ability to be nimble. So how did you keep that part of the company alive?
Although agility or nimbleness was not specifically one of Lovesac's values, I think all of the other values, grit and insatiable learner and all these other things, were a root of people being so agile, right? So it was understanding that if you need to turn on a dime, you need to turn on a dime. And that flows through the whole organization. I think that's really having a foundational values that allows you to be that. Even if that's not called out as one of your values, all the underlying values allowing you to be that way. And I think that's one of Lovesac's secret sauce too. It's the people that they hire, right? To be in a company that is growing so fast, you need to be able to move pretty fast. That's a key. And not underestimating that on the point of hiring, right? It's really looking at a track record of people being nimble and insatiable learners and being part of building out companies. That's really big when you come into Lovesac. They're not necessarily looking for everybody that's been at the tippy top of their game 100% of their career, but has progressed throughout their career, taken on new roles and responsibilities, taken on new challenges, not afraid of the word no, right? Because I always say that you can't be afraid of the word no, but not to be afraid of making a tough decision. Tough decisions are not the easiest thing to do, but making a fully informed decision. And I think that all comes into play. But if the company has the right values on the inset of when they're looking for their the people that they're bringing on board, I think all this other stuff just happens naturally.
And that's actually a great lead to my next question. You talk about those values and how important those are. There is a slight cultural adjustment that needs to inevitably happen when you're thinking of going from private to public. And so what have been some of your observations about some of the biggest gotchas in terms of the cultural adjustments, and how have you helped to lead the organization through some of those changes?
I think, you know, with Lovesac, having been private for, say, 19 years, they shared everything. Everybody in the organization knew sales by the second. Well, probably not the second, by the minute, right? Like it was information overflow, and to the point where when you met your goals, everybody got M&Ms and delivering M&Ms to the house and, you know, big cheers and, you know, even when I joined the company, there's a call that happens every Tuesday. And at the time it was, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 people on a call. And even when we went remote, we didn't stop doing those calls. Like those calls happen every Tuesday, like clockwork, and, you know, it covers new hires and people's anniversaries, and it highlights, I don't want to say an associate of the week, but a team of the week. And it's a real morale builder. So what we had to do was, first of all, explain to people when you go public, what does that really mean? And especially with, you know, information that can't be shared beyond what was already shared out on the street. So an education as to, we're not just cutting you off because we don't think that you need this information, but we're going to tailor the information a little bit different. And here's why. You need to understand why, right? You need all of your team's buy-in as to how that information might be presented a little bit different, might be truncated. We may not share as much information, but if we're not going to share all that detailed information, keeping the team very involved through these other things like recognizing team's accomplishments and celebrating an anniversary and celebrating a new hire. So keeping all that momentum going. And ultimately, the team doesn't realize how much information that you've pulled out from them. And I don't mean pulled out from them, but you're not sharing as much information, but you're still celebrating everybody's wins, maybe a little bit differently.
You touch on that important piece of it feels different for employees. And I had that experience as well in taking a company public where explaining that why and even some of it being, hey, some of this information we're going to make sure that we're limiting who needs to know it. And that's who will see it because you're protecting employees in that because sometimes mm-hmm. employees don't even realize that how that information could actually get them into trouble if they were to share it outside of your organization. So there's a piece of it that's actually protecting the company, but also your employees.
We had our SEC counsel come in and present, right? We've talked about it. We've had our internal counsel, but remembering to do that, especially with a company that's growing, because today, I'm making this up, those 400 associates could have heard it. Next year, when you're 650, you might have 250 people that haven't heard that same why. So it's the continuing of the re-education. And to your point, protecting the associates with not having that insider information.
Now, let's move over into internal controls, inevitably a big part of being a public company. How did you go about breathing life into those internal controls so that they became something that wasn't just sitting on a shelf in finance?
So the education, again, is really important. LoveSack, and you know, maybe next year will be the year, I'm not sure. But while I was there, we still weren't at a point where we had internal audit. So we had an external, we had a firm that worked alongside management for documenting process, narratives, flow charting process, controls, testing controls, reporting to management, designing risk matrix, assessing risk, doing all that for us. So we worked very closely with them. But we also had that firm come in to present periodically to the senior leaders and to teams that would be that are a part of this control, because although they're financial controls, the way you have to think about it is any process within an organization that drives some piece of, you know, financial information is a financial control. So it's not where I think people may think about this is, well, it's controls and, you know, it's only the finance and accounting team that have to worry about this. No, I mean, it goes down to how are your orders going out of the warehouse and are you making sure that you have revenue recognition correct? And how are your cutoff procedures? And, you know, from a marketing standpoint, whether or not you have direct marketing or non-direct marketing, or you're working with credits or not, what are the controls around that? And, you know, some people or new systems that come up online, right? Whether it maybe you bring in a new program that does your stock compensation accounting or whatever it may be. It's the IT team making sure that the controls are on. There are so many controls, or your POS system, whatever it may be, upgrading a POS system. So really under making the team acknowledge, and I'm talking team outside of finance, and understand what their roles and responsibilities are in internal controls. And again, that's evolving all the time as well. So it's not, to your point, documenting and putting it on a shelf, because if your processes are changing and your systems are changing, everything needs to evolve. When last year when I was at Lovesac, we instituted a new POS system. That's pretty substantial, right, to revenue recognition. And we were on the same POS system from the beginning of time to right before we went on to new POS. And that's a full evaluation of controls and, you know, what's happening on the front end at the POS register, and how are those sales being accumulated, and how is your sales audit team involved with that, and how is your sales team involved? So it's we did it by constant education. We did it by buy-in, but we also did it by where I said that we have these Tuesday afternoon meetings, rallies. There's also a once a week senior management team meeting, and we would bring up those statistics in those meetings as well, right? Like we would say, okay, there are, I'm making this up, 162 financial controls that are being tested this fiscal year. Here's the areas, and we would do a red and green chart. Nobody wanted to be in the red, right? So it's a little bit like ownership to a larger team without like calling you out. Everybody wanted to be in the green, right? Because those senior leaders are probably not the people who are involved on those day-to-day controls, but their teams are. So we had accountability up at the senior level as well. We made it that important that in these senior leadership meetings, not only were we talking about sales and strategy, we were talking about controls as well. So the senior leadership understanding that that's as important as sales goals or these sparkly things, right? The really sexy things that we do, controls are as important to the organization. So really bringing it up to that level where teams are talking about it, you know, not just behind the scenes, but at an executive management level as well.
Such a good idea. And because you really do need that ownership right from the top in terms of helping build out that environment. And like you said, people may not even realize what's happening below them. But when you're looking at it that mm-hmm. way, it certainly sparks, I better make sure I'm on top of this. So really good idea. Can you talk a bit about how you see the CFO role change after going public, whether that's how the time is spent or, you know, just where the focus areas are or priorities change?
I would say that financial planning becomes a little bit more or more oversight to the CFO role, because the market or your investors, they're not investing on what you can do today. They want to see what you can do 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years from now, right? So that financial, just the strategy alone, I think for me specifically, you make sure you build a team that can deal with day-to-day operations, but not taking your finger off, because you're responsible for that as well, right? So it's not taking the oversight. But I think for me specifically, it was, and that's why I am thrilled to still be working along Lovesac in a senior strategic advisory role, because it was a function that we kept evolving with that CFO role. But you do know that, you know, day-to-day things happen. It's, you know, SEC filings and vendors getting paid and all that other stuff that happens, you know, and a close and budgets and annual operating plans. But I think becoming more strategic and being able to understand future plans is really important as you evolve the CFO role, especially at a public company, because again, investors are not investing in what you can do today. They're investing in what they see on your strategic roadmap. and being able to build that and communicate that. I think that's the other thing too. Investor relations is a world that I think you need to personally become more comfortable in, as far on a public company scale as well. And feeling comfortable, we go back to the story, right? It's the story that you IPO'd, and how is that story evolving, and the confidence in that story, and how do you tell that story, and how do you talk to investors? So it definitely is very, I think for my career, and I always loved being in a public company. As you know, I started out in public, and I went to a public company, and then went to a private company, and reverse triangular merged it into a public company, and then took a company public. So I like that. But the other thing, you know, I had talked about is you, when we talk public, so are you, right? You are now a public figure, not public figure in the way of, you know, political public figure, unless you are behind the scenes out of your CFO role, but you become a public entity. It's not only LoveSack is public, but, you know, I don't want to say every move you make, but every move within LoveSack, your compensation and your bonuses, and, you know, it's equity and, you know, what are the associates? The associates see that now too, right? So it's your associates, your coworkers. So that's another thing. I don't want to say changes or my role evolved, but I think anybody that hasn't been in a public company that becomes, let's say, a reporting officer of a public company, you just need to wrap your head around that. You know, I joke when I was on, when I was the CFO of the fragrance company, we were located on Long Island. My husband is in financial services as well. And my salary would get public, you know, there would be the list of the top 100 companies on Long Island every single year in the local newspaper, and it would have my name and my salary, you know. So people would say to my husband, oh, we see what your wife makes or whatever. You just got to be okay with that. Like, that's the other thing. It might seem really trivial, but just know that you become as public as the public company does too.
Yeah, I think that's a really great reminder. So with the benefit of hindsight, is there any sage advice that you would give to your pre-IPO version of yourself?
My pre-IPO version, I think it would be a little bit more patience, although I think I'm a pretty patient person. It would be a little bit more patient, understanding, you know, it takes time. I don't even want to say to perfect, because I don't think anything is ever perfected. But I think it would be understanding. And, you know, the other thing is too, and I say this to myself and I say this to others too, is it seems so direct, but don't let the stock price be the reflection of how you think the company is doing, and the, you know, because that's the other thing. LoveSack was a point where the stock went up to 80. Should it have been at 80? Not quite sure. It was up there for a period of time, right? We IPO'd at $16. It was up at 80. They're now hovering in the 22, 23. But that's not a reflection of how the company is doing. That's a reflection of the market's doing, right? So I think for me, it took me a little while of that too, like not being disappointed. Are we not doing our job? If the stock price, obviously we need to make sure that the stock price is where it should be. But if there's certain things that you can't control, so that's probably a reflection too, as far as don't let your mood go up and down as the stock price does too. Make sure that you understand that the company's executing on what they're executing on. But especially for the associates that are not privy to the level of execution, and all they do is see the stock price. That's one of the things there, you know, on these Tuesday calls we would have is we would address it every once in a while, but not to where it was being redundant. And we wanted people to focus on the stock price, but we felt it was important to bring that up to the rest of the team that really the company is executing, but unfortunately, due to market conditions or, you know, something, or guilty by association, we may say, by another, you know, other furniture companies or whatever it may be. So those are the things. I think patience, you know, not letting the stock price get you down, although everybody tries to, you know, make sure that we're getting the most shareholder value. And those would probably be the biggest things I would reflect on as far as taking a company public and being in the public arena.
There may be some listeners who are working with companies that maybe they're not necessarily thinking of going public just now, and especially with markets not really being open. But if they're thinking that down the road, that might be a path they want to take, what are the top three things you think they should be doing right now to prepare?
It goes back to foundations, right? The controls, I would say, is number one. Even when I was with a private company, when companies were private, I thought of them as public companies. So the standard of your controls should, and the rigor around controls, I don't think you should, even as a private company, I'm a big control believer, right? They're there for a reason. You know, they're just required for public companies because of, you know, all of the compliance around it. But I think controls are a good practice for a private or public company, but don't take your eye off controls. Continue to build those. The financial rigor, your forecasting model, I think is something that you should continue to build on. And then I think the team as well is looking internally at what your team and not taking your foot off the gas, right? Because that the IPO market could open for you at any point in time. And you don't want to look back and say, wow, I need another 6 or 8 months because I wasn't really thinking about controls. You just want to be IPO ready at any point in time. So controls, I go back to the foundation, you know, making sure the foundation is there. And the other one is really being able to project and working on that projection and forecasting model.
Great pieces of advice. And so now, if we look at where you are today, and you've recently handed over the reins at Lovesac, and you've moved into more of an advisory role, how did you know when it was the right time to make that transition?
Oof, it doesn't happen overnight. I think I'm a big planner, and even plans change, right? So it's not where I can say I'm making this up, where I'm going to be retired at 55. You know, that was not my plan. I didn't plan to be, you know, retired at a certain age. It's when I felt personally and professionally that Lovesac was at a good point. I don't even want to say to hand over the reins, but a transition was at good timing for both me personally and professionally. You know, I believe in other people being given an opportunity as well. And there's a lot of talent across the board at Lovesac. A couple of years ago, they had brought in a new president that was actually somebody who is on our board that I had worked very closely with. And, you know, that actually probably caused me to rethink a little bit more as to what my timeline was from extending it out a little bit, right? Because I thoroughly enjoy working with her. But I saw the team really evolve. And it was time, you know, behind the scenes, my husband and I, I don't sit still. I don't play golf. It was not one of those things where I want to, you know, be on the golf course every single day. But I wanted to continue because I don't play golf. I've never played golf. But it was one of those things where I felt at my point in my career, it was time for me to step into a different role. And it's hard. It's hard to say that's, you know, how that comes about for each person is probably very, very different. But I also planned financially for myself that, you know, as I transitioned into a new role or other roles or whatever it may be, because, you know, I wasn't leaving Lovesac to be the CFO at another company. I knew at that point that I had contributed enough to that level in my career. I now wanted to advise. But it, again, being an officer of a public company, that doesn't just happen today and you tell them tomorrow and it all changes. I don't think that normally happens. It's never happened in my career, but you need to plan for that, right? I care a lot about LoveSac. I love the brand. I love the associates. I love the team. I love the vision. That I wanted to make sure that they were in the right spot as I transitioned into a new role. And how others define that, it's very, very, I guess it's unique to each person, but I think you would know. But I'm a big planner. I mean, that's, I plan a lot.
Isn't it, when we're in the finance realm. Donna, thank you so much for sharing your experience. You have so much to share and so much that our listeners can learn from today. So really appreciate that. Now, whenever we do have a guest on, we have two rapid fire questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
First one is, what is the best piece of business or leadership advice that you've ever received?
There was a gentleman who I knew that I didn't work with, believe it or not, but it was somebody who was very successful, who started out one day selling aluminum siding. So he's older, right? Because now it's vinyl siding, but he started out selling aluminum siding. And then he actually progressed to the point where he owned, I don't know, 17, 18 or 20 McDonald's franchises and started out, you know, frying French fries. But what he said to me, and this is about 20 something years ago, fail to plan, plan to fail. And it seems a little harsh. And I don't think that's his saying. I don't know who originally said it, but he's the one that said it to me. And I said, wow, that is so true. But I'm a big planner. I write lists for everything. Drives my husband crazy, but I write lists for everything. It's like, what are we going to do today? What do we need to accomplish? So I think that's what it is. And I think you can apply that to not only to business. I think I talk to my nieces who are, you know, thinking about going off to college and, you know, what are they going to do for their careers or just when they were going to high school or whatever it may be. But I think you can pretty much modify that and apply fail to plan, plan to fail in anything that you do. So I would say that something that repeats over and over and over to me.
Great piece of advice. Now, the next question is, what is the most impactful book that you've read? And that can be business or just a personal book.
This is going to sound really funny when I say this, and I don't know if you've ever read this. And I was given this book in 2008, right before we reverse triangular mergered with Perfumania. And it's called Who Moved My Cheese?
I've not heard of it.
Have you ever heard of the book? Okay. All right. So it sounds really weird and elementary, but sometimes you just need elementary things to read as far as the basics. And it really talks about organizational change, right? It talks about how do people deal with change? How do people accept change? What do you do with change? What does change mean? And I'm telling you, it is the smallest, easy read book that somebody gave to me. So it may not sound like I am this big literary person, but if you said to like you're asking me that question, it's the first book that comes to mind. It's Who Moved My Cheese? So I would highly recommend, if you haven't read it, it's as basic, and it's in a book that anybody in your organization can read. You know, it's anybody in your family, it's your kids or your nieces or anything, because I think you can apply it. It's not like this big technical book or anything like that. It's enjoyable. So I would highly recommend Who Moved My Cheese.
I love the title. So that one will definitely stand out in my head. Donna, again, thank you so much. Really appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Thank you. This was great. Really appreciate it.
If you'd like to learn more about today's episode, please visit the links in the show notes. And remember to subscribe wherever you listen to or watch your podcasts. And we'd also love to hear from you, our audience. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to see more of. And leave us a review on any of the streaming platforms. For the CFO Show, I'm your host, Melissa Howitson. Until next time.